Ideas in STEM Ed is a production of the Idea Engineering Student Center at UC San Diego, which works to promote community, success, and inclusion at all levels. My name is Darren Lapomi, Professor of Nanoengineering and Chemical Engineering and Faculty Director of the Idea Center. The purpose of this podcast is to provide a forum for the discussion of innovative and inclusive approaches to teaching and mentoring, and to support the personal and academic flourishing and success of students in science and engineering. To learn more about the Idea Center, visit jacobschool.ucsd.edu/idea. Shigang Suo is the Alan E. and Marilyn M. Puckett Professor of Mechanics and Materials in the Harvard School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. Professor Suo obtained his BS degree from Jian Jiaotan University in 1985 and PhD in Mechanical Engineering from Harvard University in 1989. He began his independent career at UC Santa Barbara, moved to Princeton in 1997, and to Harvard in 2003. It was during this period that I became aware of Zhigang's work when he attended some of our more mechanics-oriented group meetings. Zhigang has been a leader in the thermomechanical reliability of semiconductor devices and did some of the first mechanical analyses on soft matter devices critical to haptics, robotics, adhesives, and human-machine interfaces. He is an engaging public speaker and storyteller, and his talks generate standing room-only crowds at conferences. In this episode, we talked about his trajectory and his career and life and challenges facing Asian and Chinese American scientists and engineers. Welcome, Zhigang. Thank you very much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you, Darren.
So tell me a little bit about your interest in mechanics and where it arose from.
So when I had my high school degree in China, and also my college, attended college in China as well. So that was 1981. So there was a national entrance exam. And then we were supposed, after the exam, we were supposed to say what was our wish, which university, which specialty. In China, at that point, the disciplines are finely divided. So I didn't know what to do. So how funny, it could be, there would be 30, 60 people at a university specialized in welding. And another 30, 60 people specialized in refrigeration. So I had no clue I could commit to these things.
Very specific topics.
Very specific. I was told it was influenced by Russian system. I don't know these things myself. So, but my parents both were college lecturers at that time. They taught English. They didn't know anything about refrigeration or welding, such things. They couldn't really advise me. They took me to my father, took me to somebody who had knowledge of the university, the same university my parents working. And this guy said, "Oh, I knew you were good with mathematics, but China is building up. We don't need that many mathematicians, and our university is not that good with mathematics. How about mechanics?" I already studied mechanics in high school. Why should I study mechanics again? Oh, no, this mechanics is different. Mm-hmm. This is about building bridges, building airplanes. So I thought it could be fine. So at that time, my only good subject was mathematics. So that was it, because the universe require us after 18 years old time declare a specific major, and the mechanics was the only thing kind of related to me. So that was it.
That's fantastic. So when Professor John Hutchinson toured, went on a long tour of China and ended up in your town at your university. You had a meeting with him, and this meeting changed your career trajectory. You did your PhD at Harvard and eventually became an assistant professor at Santa Barbara, and then went to Princeton. Now, this is sort of where our intellectual histories intersect, because you had a senior colleague, Sigurd Wagner, who is an electrical engineer and came to you with a problem on large area electronics, flexible electronics, and studying thermomechanical behavior of interfaces. And I wonder, how did you think about this this transition from mechanics of hard materials to mechanics of soft materials? Was it a big jump for you, or was it a fairly simple, you know, a transition?
Yeah, well, that was interesting. So when I was at UC Santa Barbara before Princeton, UC Santa Barbara was my first academic position. So there was a huge activity there on ceramic matrix composite. So that's a terrific idea. So these are airplane engines. The idea is to use a higher and higher temperature, so you can do a fuel efficiency, and you can also burn things more completely, maybe environmentally sound. That was a time, that was in late 80, early 90. So there was a terrific guy, I don't know if you know this, heard of this person, Tony Evans. He was a leader at Santa Barbara, intellectual leader. Very charismatic Welsh. Very charismatic. Anyway, he got us all together to study ceramic matrix composite. So my role was to do mechanics analysis. Ceramic matrix is a terrific idea. Ceramic can sustain high temperature, but it was too brittle. So nobody would think it was a good idea to use ceramics to make engines. But around that time, even before that, clever people thought about it. So they said all ceramics are brittle, but if you combine two together, somehow they become ductile. It can be as ductile as steel. It was terrific. So I was, it was not my idea, not even Tony Evans' idea, but it was a serious development he was leading. I was doing mathematical mechanics analysis of these experiments, materials. So that was, around that time, there was also a friend who joined Intel as engineer. So that was early 90s. And he discovered that he had a materials science background from MIT, was a postdoc at UC Santa Barbara. We got to be a good friend. So then he joined Intel. He noticed at Intel, people were developing structures at a much smaller scale, not bridges, not airplanes, but much smaller. Mm-hmm. And these people, engineers, remarkable engineers, they're doing things by trial and error, was somehow fine, but doesn't seem to be sustainable. So he decided he wanted, and his friends, colleagues, wanted to introduce some aerospace thinking into designing small structure. So big structures are right designed for mechanical reliability, experiment designed, and a small structure were not designed for reliability, just for function, right? You need to be a transistor. If especially when you make a transistor, you have multiple materials together. During fabrication, you have a very high temperature, 500 degrees C, and then room temperature, many materials, thermal contraction, expansion, cause a lot of residual stress. Also, if you have seen these structures under microscope, these are just really almost like a civil engineering structure, bridges, intricate structures, different materials. So reliability is a very serious issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very serious issue. So, and he got me involved in this kind of microelectronic structure mechanics problem. Again, while I was doing analysis mechanics, so that's a condition when I went to Princeton. So Sigurd Wagner, just a terrific guy. He was in electrical engineering. I was in mechanical and aerospace. But at Princeton, we have a special arrangement. So my office and his office are very nearby on the same floor by coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
He was an early riser. I was an early riser. So 7 o'clock in the morning, he often came to my office to describe his problem. What are you doing in Shigang? I was very proud. He's an electrical engineer. I told him, I collaborate with Intel.
Mm-hmm.
He immediately laughed at me. Why do you want to work with Intel? This is an old industry. We're at Princeton. We need to create a new industry. Instead of doing microelectronics, we should do macroelectronics, big. So we say, yeah. Electronics get smaller, but people don't get smaller. People need to have large monitors, displays. That's what we're doing. That was so he was pushing initially literally pushing large screen displays, electronics. So that's how I got involved. Sigurd was really an intellectual leader in many ways. He not influenced me and influenced a number of other colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
And he also organized some national meeting, went to DARPA. We all went to DARPA. At DARPA meeting, I actually met two future leaders, John Rogers,
mm-hmm.
and your postdoc advisor, right?
Chen-An Bao.
Yeah, Chen-An Bao, yes. Yeah. Before that, I didn't know them. So we were talking about the title of the workshop cooked up by Sigurd and his DARPA friend. It's called Sensitive Steams. So that was the beginning of electronic e-steams. Well, I learned things from him. You ask whether it's an easy transition or not. Initially, it wasn't too difficult because initially we were just doing, so one project was just doing a curved surface, put a transistor on the curved surface. So because it's a curve, so you can do camera image a little better. So it mimic, I guess, eye a little better. So the material is plastics, and then you just somehow make curve and put transistor on top of that. We figure out a way, actually publish a paper how you do that. So initially it wasn't too hard for doing mechanics. The difficulty really came in when Sigurd wanted to do stretchable.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is also where interfacial mechanics and material science, and particularly soft organic material science, have a very fruitful intersection.
Yeah.
And I've noticed that your work has become decidedly more molecular, closer to the chemistry in recent years. Is that a deliberate choice or a choice out of necessity, or is that where the interesting problems arose?
So now at Princeton, I still limit, my whole group was doing computation, mechanics analysis. So I learned with Seegert a little bit about how elastomer worked. I didn't know I actually knew anything about hydrogels at that time. It wasn't even in the vocabulary of Seegert. So, and then I had this opportunity to return to Harvard as a faculty. So then it has something to do with your advisor, George Whitesides. So a Princeton colleague, Johan Axe, chemical engineer, material scientist, he and I had been collaborating when I was at Princeton. I moved to Harvard. We continue to collaborate. Johan has had very good collaboration with George Whitesides. So he brought me and George together, three of us and other people wrote a Murie proposal, got funded. So for that project, we were supposed to do stretchable electrodes. I happen to know quite a bit about electroactive materials, starting with the piezoelectric ceramics. So I knew something about electrodes. But with George's mind is such a fluid. So the moment he recognized what is electrodes, everything become electrodes. As long as your charge somehow is separated, liquid become electrodes, polymer become, everything is electrodes. Okay, I need to do something about something electrical. So that was fine with me. I had previous experience with a piezoelectric ceramics. Mm-hmm. When I was in Santa Barbara. So I decided to, I was looking for projects, what to do. So then around that time, one thing lead to another, we started to look at dielectric elastomer. You probably know something about it. So these are just a regular dielectric insulating rubber-like material. So, and when you apply voltage, it's an insulator, as a capacitor. So positive electrode, negative electrode, they attract each other, squeeze the material, and the material area become larger. So that is actuation, change voltage to a deformation.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a soft material, deformation can be very large. So I begin to do these electroactive soft material. And then, so at Harvard, so we have a very, so on the same floor, just a few offices down, David Mooney is bioengineer. He is a world leading expert on hydrogels.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we started to do hydrogel. At that time, there was a terrific student in my group, Xuan He Zhao. You probably know him.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, yeah.
Extraordinarily successful professor at MIT. And he led the initial interaction with David Mooney's group.
Mm-hmm.
So at Harvard, we're so collaborative. So all Xuan He need to propose, you know, I can spend one semester to take reading course with David Mooney. And David Mooney can say yes or can say no. David said yes. So at that time, Xuan He, all his background, he was an electrical engineer at undergraduate level and a material computational person as a master from a Canadian place. Came to Harvard just as a theoretical person. No background in soft material.
Yeah.
No background in experiments. And then just because this opportunity, we have a funding through George Whiteside's electrons, everything electrons. there's an opportunity. We initially published a few papers, just a mechanics about alginate, how this seaweed derived hydrogel, how mechanical, that material mechanical behavior. People knew something, but we felt we can make some contribution. Publish a few papers. One thing leads to another. We developed this version of tough hydrogel that led to a paper in Nature. That was a very big breakthrough for our group. All the experiments were done at David Mooney's lab. I had no lab at that point. So Xuan He got a few other people in my group interested. So these were all, actually there was a Korean visiting student, later become postdoc, Jen Yong Sung.
Sure, I know. He was actually a visiting scholar in my lab last year until the pandemic cut his visit short.
He was very creative. Very creative. At that time, he was a visiting student at Harvard. Later on, became a postdoc. So he stayed at Harvard, I don't know how many years, quite a number of years, 4, 5, 6 years, I forgot. Mm-hmm. So, and he, Jen Yong Sung, became a leader of that project. But initial material, initial concept was really conceived by Xuan He.
Mm-hmm.
We create a first version. Because the intimate involvement of this project, these young people really taught me how to think about the behavior, mechanical behavior, in terms of molecules, hydrogel polymer and another polyacrylamide. My own field, starting from PhD time, really was fracture mechanics, how fracture work initially in metals, then in ceramics, then in composites, and then in stretchable electronics. But the way we think about these fracture, it's always from atomic point of view. For example, for metal, because a fracture ultimately involves breaking atomic bonds and also flowing things. So that wasn't hard, thinking about atomically, at molecular level. But the new dimension is, instead of just thinking about and computing it, I had to translate that thinking into something you can make.
Mm-hmm.
That's a new constraint. Yeah, that's how it started.
Sure. So your work is very fundamental, but your degrees are in engineering. You have taught in engineering departments. Do you consider yourself a scientist or an engineer, or is the distinction not useful, as George Whitesides would say?
George Whitesides, George is probably the world's most famous engineer.
With no degrees in engineering.
So, of course, I have a huge admirer, fan of George's approach. Quite natural for me the moment I got a chance to really interact with him quite extensively. Of course, he has many, many people interacting with him extensively. So, the distinction, I think, is real. Scientist and engineer. My understanding is, the fundamental role of a scientist really is to understand nature. So, of course, fundamental role of engineer is to create something nature doesn't have. So that role, I think, is real. This distinction is real. But for individual, it's hard to make that distinction. Once you understand a little bit of nature and you see something's missing that can help people, you start to create.
Sure.
So often our work, it's also genuine. There's some have something about inspiration. Sometimes that inspiration is a little fake, but often I think it's genuine, because you have to almost have to see things are in action. That's a stimulation, and the natural world provides so many examples, unusual, interesting, that provide you way to think about things.
I often get in trouble with chemists when I say that organic chemistry is philosophically engineering, because at the end of the day, you need to put something in a bottle or on a windshield or on nail polish or on laminate flooring. I'd like to switch gears a little bit. You talked a bit about some international students who and visiting scholars that you've had in your lab. You yourself were an international student. And the bravery of my international students never ceases to impress me, especially with regard to language comprehension, coming to a new country for the first time, especially language comprehension in a highly technical area. So I'd like to first ask you, how did you manage at Harvard when you in your first semester as a new English learner?
Wow. Yeah, I cannot remember. Oh, no, I cannot forget. Sorry. Because this just burned into the brain, the humility. My parents, they were both English. They taught English in my own college in China. But they themselves learned English when they were adults. So, because they were originally trained to teach Russian. Yeah, during Cultural Revolution, suddenly Russian became not useful. So they actually both learned English in their late 30s.
Wow. As I can attest, not an easy time to learn a new language.
Right. So I didn't appreciate that, right? So, but they muddled through both, at that time, not many people had the skill anyway. They had to do it as a literally, they learn English in the morning and begin to teach in the afternoon or something like this. Well, one semester they learn English, next semester they have to teach. So that kind of thing. There's still during Cultural Revolution, very interesting time. So they did that. They never managed to make me interested in English as a language. So I was muddling through, but at that time, because there's a terrific man in China, Deng Xiaoping, you probably heard this man, he had a very simple vision for China, need to lift people out of poverty. You can eat and you can wear things. So not wealthy, but can live a normal life. So that was in 70s, 80s, he had this dream. And his goal is by 2000, most Chinese people could do that. That was his stated goal. And he accomplished that eventually. Anyway, so then even by that time, I was in high school in 70s, our Cultural Revolution ended in 1976. And immediately almost overnight, the country started, oh, we're going to need engineers. We're going to build the country. So I guess there was always understanding China was maybe 50 years behind the advanced world. I don't know where people came out. There's a 50 years, 5-0. And then we need to do it in 2000, not to reach that level of advancement, but at least make people live reasonably well. So engineers. And therefore, we need to learn from a Western world, and we need to study English. So I think I started to learn English. This is a mandatory in high school.
Mm-hmm.
But my parents were never interested enough or made enough effort to interest me so that they could give me special lessons. So my English was okay in high school, muddle through, but in college, it was immediate clear. English was the most important skill that mm-hmm. young men and young women need to have. Why? So good young men and young women need to go to America or go to Europe. Yeah. So mm-hmm. so I just spend I think half of my time studying English when I was in college. Mostly through reading. So our professors were all native Chinese. They couldn't really speak very well. So their way of instruction is through grammar
mm-hmm.
and through reading and writing. So when by the time so I passed an examination, got to United States. TOEFL score was pretty high. I've forgotten the number, but it was high. Then when I came to this country, I could read, I could write very well. I guess by Chinese standard. Hutchinson said I could write well, but he still corrects me saying,
well, that's high praise.
So my advisor. Anyway, the difficulty was speaking. It was difficult. But most difficult was listening.
Mm-hmm.
Listening, you couldn't control the speed. In class, I couldn't understand things. So there was a course taught by Professor Spoppen. He's a dear colleague now.
Yeah, I know him.
Yeah, he was a young man from Europe, Belgium, had thick European accent. I could hardly understand him. Also, his course is so deep and broad in material science. I had no background. In class, I couldn't understand him at all. I had to read. He didn't have a textbook. I had a stack of textbook, just looking for hints, things. He kind of talked about similar figures. It was very, very hard.
So what can we do as instructors to make it easier for international students to learn from us?
I think English level now has improved, I believe. Today, students came with a better skill in listening and listening comprehension and speaking better than I had. They probably couldn't write as well I did, but they improved. So I didn't notice a serious difficulty
mm-hmm.
with foreign students, Koreans and the Chinese, couldn't notice difference. Mm-hmm. Also Iranian, no. Yeah, so I don't know. I don't believe it's still a huge barrier, at least from instruction.
Yeah, that's great. That's great to see, because international students are the lifeblood of our graduate programs, and it leads me into the next topic, which is the Justice Department. And I don't know how much we want to go on the record here, but I wonder if you have any comments as to what the Justice Department gets wrong about the way science is done in the United States.
Oh, this is a huge topic. I don't know how much you follow this development yourself, Professor Charlie Lieber, right? From your own old department, Charlie Lieber.
Yeah.
Nobody could dream he would be connected with espionage.
Yeah.
Like Charlie Lieber, espionage. How ridiculous that could be. Now he probably was the most famous case of this China initiative started by Justice Department 2018. How much do you follow these cases at all?
I know quite a bit. I think I know more than the median academic. I have a special interest in it because one time, so let me back up. Occasionally we get emails on campus from the Office of Export Controls and Legal Counsel that tell us that if a representative of a government agency comes to the door, to not talk to them, but to call the appropriate campus representative. And I think I had forgotten that instruction at the time, because some people came to the door and were, I was in a meeting at the time, but you know, if they flash the badge, you have to do what they say, right? Or so I thought, because it seemed to me that my, that if I got on the phone and called legal counsel, it'll look like I had done something wrong. And this must happen all the time, because, you know, it couldn't have just been me, right? I mean, I don't do any classified research. I have grants from the DOD, but it's all unclassified. The work, we want to publish it. And moreover, the NIH and NSF have mandatory open access policies. So your work must be made available on PubMed or the NSF equivalent 12 months after the publication of the article. So it seems to me that there is a disconnect in the way that research funding is administered and this, you know, these accusations of espionage and foreign dissemination of research of publicly funded research results that are not classified. I mean, what is the point of a scientific paper, right? If not to to disseminate the information as widely as possible. So, you know, at the time, I felt a little bit humiliated by my, you know, my response, which is, you know, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, I'll be good, sir. I will not let my leave my laptop unattended when traveling internationally. and that's, you know, that was good enough for them. And it was very cryptic, it was bullying. I think my, you know, I replay scenarios in my head where I'm in a meeting with a student, and even after they flash the badge, I tell them, I'm in a meeting, can you wait? I should have said that, right? But, you know, I thought I was in trouble.
Yeah. So now, I don't really know, just these things, never understand. So for all these years, so I came to this country, just to use my own, myself as an example, came to this country in 86. The first time I actually went back to China, it's 2000, 14 years after. So then in subsequent years, initially maybe or once every other year, I would go back because my parents still there. they could visit, but they got old. I need to see them. So, and China probably, just around that time, they're doing very well. They became heavily funding scientific research. That was new around that time it all began. So then I became, went back maybe every year. So each time, of course, people ask me to give a talk, right? But not once there is even a hint that you do some spying. I guess these people probably intelligent enough to know I have no unusual information to really give to them. It's just publish information, teach them what we publish, explain, give just a usual scientific talk. So, and then because my parents get older and older, so it almost, I have to go back once a year. So then my host, tired of just each time arrange your accommodation. Why don't we give you a ongoing visiting appointment? Sure. So, right, that was it. Never crossing my mind this kind of thing could be potential problem. But in hindsight, of course it could be. But I guess the White House recently, mm-hmm. Eric Lender said it very clearly that in future, the United States need to have very clear rules for disclosure.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So in the past at Harvard, you know this.
Yeah.
Anytime if you receive money more than $5,000, you need to disclose. I make sure I do that, right? If anybody invite me to have a dinner, do I disclose that? If I start to make notes for that, I won't have time to do the real things, right?
Yeah.
So the disclosure rule just recently, even at Harvard, has changed. It's almost anything in kind, even without any money, you need to disclose. So then I think the scope become A, very different from before. B, that create huge possibility of making mistakes.
How do you think that this attitude of the government has affected the climate of for our Chinese American and international students from China and researchers of Chinese origin in general?
Well, it sent in the field, it's called a chilling effect. Mm-hmm. It's genuine. So the concrete thing is a number of things are. So we have recently started a new organization called Asian American Scholars Forum.
Mm-hmm.
So initially just organize webinars to educate scholars, also try to engage people from government, DOJ, and engage people from university to see there must be some misunderstanding here, because none of us, searching our heart, had any experience closely related to espionage.
Sure, of course.
We don't have that experience, so we cannot really talk about it. But there is something clear misunderstanding. Our colleagues, close colleagues, gets charged, indicted. What is going on? So the educational active cannot be just on us. DOJ need to learn something. So writing a recommendation letter for any student is almost a job requirement. We have to do it. Mm-hmm. That should not be part of the indictment.
Yeah.
So if you read Gong Chen's, part of one entry is Gong Chen actually wrote letter of recommendation for people apply job in China. How absurd.
Yeah, that is absolutely reprehensible.
Yeah, too low. Either too arrogant to learn or too hideous to make up things, fool people who don't understand. just I don't know which is which. Either way, it's not very good.
Yeah. There's a lot of language we use in academia, even by well-meaning people, for that are harmful, you know, to our case of inclusion. And one of those words that's recently started to make me bristle is the word cash cow to describe the relationship of international students to especially public universities, because they pay full tuition in master's programs. Pay full tuition, they're generally not supported by federal grants, and a large portion of the tuition budget comes from international students. Yet the critique on, you know, among faculty members, you know, democratic voting, liberal leaning faculty members, is to say that international students are a cash cow, where the target of that derision is supposed to be the administration, but the actual recipient of that denigration is the student themselves. And I hear that word now and it makes my head explode. Like, we are not creating allies using this language. And I guess that's not a question, more of a of a soapbox, but
I heard a phrase like this myself, but recently I seem to be quite interesting. Recently, there was a concern whether, in particular, Chinese students can still come to this country, can get visa. So far, seem to be good in general, in terms of big numbers. There are individuals get denied for special circumstances. So that seemed to be coming back. But look, what the new phrase is, the research security. That's something really way above my knowledge about things. I don't know how much you know. So essentially, okay, you get you do research, get government money, some money from defense or energy, presumably can produce value, and you publish it, that's fine. But then people say, you also train students. These students, if they're Chinese or Korean, they are going back to their country. That's a fact too. Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt that the rapid development in Asia enormously benefited from the education they received from America.
Sure.
We Americans used to be proud of this fact. We lived up our people out of poverty.
Absolutely.
By just educating them.
But Jigong, you and I have to be careful about what we say publicly here, because if certain voters or certain members of Congress knew what fraction of the $7 billion NSF budget or $30 billion NIH budget went to the training of international graduate students and postdocs, they would be taken aback, and we may, you know, less enlightened administrations may wish to curtail that funding or place certain restrictions on whom can be trained using those resources, and that's something that has always scared me.
Yeah, it scares me also. You probably always pay attention to all kinds of things. Just knowing what I know about you, I was not very politically sensitive about things. I wasn't very interested until Gang Chen's arrest, right? Politics is just not my thing. Many people in my generation of Chinese descent, it's kind of like that. So we just left China because we really dislike politics of all kinds. Just let us do our own things, spend time with family and books. We were very happy. So, but nonetheless, I actually, this debate, between parties, I must say I can see points from both ends, right? Research security, and it is also a fact that American education or Western education, there is a massive technological transfer from textbooks, from attending schools, not by espionage. Espionage must be minute among by real wealth. I don't have statistics, but if anybody disagree with that statement, they need to show numbers.
Yeah, 99% of the sure, the vast majority of knowledge transfer is via legitimate means, and government funding paid for a lot of, most of the legitimate, or much of the legitimate transfer as well in terms of yeah.
So in one side of the in one side of the argument, I can see that the science is noble. Liberate people, right? You teach people how to fish rather than, you know, always cook fish and send to them. That seemed to be a very good strategy, right? Have a stable country, a large country, make that country chaotic. Probably it's not to anybody's interest anyway. So that's one kind of argument. The other kind of argument, hey, there is a national security and they are doing so well and they don't follow rules, that also has a lot of element of truth in that. I actually don't know at high level. At the end, I felt it has to be a political decision. Cannot, right? Cannot do massive experiment. Let's do experiments, see both ways. You cannot do that. You only have one world, come on. Political decision. So I'm all for that. Debate, heartfelt, honest debate, that's fine. But what's wrong with this DOJ 2018 rule? They are changing the rules in the middle and making up rules and then punish people who were totally innocent in the old way of doing science. It's very open. You collaborate with whoever who can collaborate with you. Has, even in the charges themselves, has no mention of espionage. The legal document has zero mention of, it's always a disclosure. Have you disclosed this tie with China or not?
Sure.
Totally different things. So espionage and the disclosure, these are two different things, but the way government, DOJ, FBI announces these cases, you can look at their for example, Twitter account, it's just hideous.
Yeah, I agree. I want to be respectful of your time. We only have about 2 minutes left, but I wanted to end on a what I think is a positive note. The field of soft materials, flexible electronics, and soft robotics is very nice. The people in it are supportive. That's my impression. And sometimes I feel like I got away easy in my scientific career by being part of such a supportive field. And I look at other fields and there are partisans. There are people who shout at conferences at each other. And I wonder if there's some characteristic of soft matter, flexible electronics, soft robotics, these areas we work in that that are especially amenable and welcoming, that make the field especially welcoming to newcomers and new ideas. I wonder if you have a reaction to that, or if you think it's true.
That is, I think that's true. Partly, I think it's because the field is relatively young, and so there are, even the most successful people are very young. Also very interdisciplinary, right? So you're a chemist by training, I'm a mechanical engineer. I really knew you have a deep knowledge in areas that I had no clue. So that bring in a lot of collaborations, that bring respect. Also mechanics, I have a knowledge, seem to be totally trivial for me. But then Sigurd Wagner was totally delighted that there's actually a field of knowledge existed. So that was very delightful. That actually we got off from a very good start, and there's a few extraordinary individuals that helped us start it.
Well, that is a wonderful note to end on. And thank you very much, Shigang, for your time. This is a great conversation, and I know our audience will appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Darren.
Thanks for listening to Ideas in STEM Ed, a production of the Idea Engineering Student Center in the Jacobs School of Engineering at UC San Diego. This episode was edited and engineered by Sky Lee, with theme music written and performed by John Viviani. Title art was created by Caitlin Wong. Special thanks to Sarah Eckerd for guest booking and marketing. The Idea Center works to promote community, success, and inclusion at all levels. To reach us for guest suggestions and other feedback, please send an email to ideadirector@eng.ucsd.edu. And to learn more about our programs, visit jacobsschool.ucsd.edu/idea. As a final note, the views expressed by me or the guests do not necessarily reflect those of the Idea Center, the Jacobs School of Engineering, or UC San Diego. See you next time.